there's this new movie that's centered around refereeing. I don't know if you've seen anything. Have you seen it come through your feed? It's like this rugby refereeing, and yeah, it'd be a good one to check out.
Okay, but it's actually a full-length movie.
Yeah, it looked like I just saw the clip of it, and they made it sound so dramatic and intense, and I've never actually thought about the experience of a referee being like imagine a big... Yeah,
when what's the World Cup one, South Africa winning the World Cup, made a big movie out of that. Invictus, no, was it Invictus? No, I think that's... but it was around Mandela, obviously, being there at the final and inspiring the nation out of the South Africans winning the World Cup at that stage. But I haven't seen any other ones.
Are you young enough to know what it was like when they came over here and everyone was protesting it?
Was I young enough? Yes, I am young enough for that. In actual fact, I'd been in South Africa the year before, 1980. I went out. My twin sister was living in Johannesburg, married to a South African, and just had their first baby, so I went out. And everyone was sort of saying, why are you going? You know, you shouldn't go to South Africa, apartheid and all that. And I was like, well, I can't change apartheid, but I can go and learn a bit more. And, hey, my sister's over there, just had a baby, I'm going anyway. But it was really interesting because, like, everybody just wanted to talk to me. Once they knew I was a New Zealander, once I knew I was into rugby, they just lining up to talk to me about the tour and about things. And even though probably, 95% of those were white South Africans, they all appeared reasonably open to the conversation. But they were keen for, obviously, the tour to go ahead. But, yeah, no, I was here in Wellington at the time. Just moved back to Wellington, actually. Didn't get involved in any protests, but was, yeah. I'm of the mind that people are allowed to protest, but it annoys me when they take out other people's lives. I don't think you should necessarily protest and affect other people's lives dramatically, but you've got a right to protest. Great believer in that.
Yeah, my old business associate, he's 68, I think. He was a police officer. At the game, and a big baton. It's kind of wild, eh? Yeah, I don't know what it was like. I've heard about it and stuff, but what was South Africa like in the 80s, like when you went there and what you saw? Were the things that stood out?
You didn't see apartheid overtly. There was nothing there. I was out, I was into running at the time. My brother-in-law was into running big time. Particularly long distances, very long distances. He ran a thing called the Comrades Marathon, which is like 92 kilometres, crazy stuff, in the very hot heat of South Africa. And you saw black people were around, didn't mix with them that much. I was probably in the white community, but there was the way things were. It was very relaxed. Johannesburg was a lot cleaner and better than what I was back out again about 10 years ago, and Johannesburg had become very, very dirty and a lot of shuttered shops and all that kind of thing. But back then, in the 80s, it was very open, very clean. Loved it. Great country. I went down to Durban. Absolutely beautiful down there on the coast. I was in the Kruger National Park. The animals are probably, as out in their natural habitat, was probably the most spectacular thing for me to see them like that after only ever seeing it on TV.
Mm. So,
but no, it was a lovely country. Everything seemed to be working back then, but I was just really, although I was there for quite a few months, it was very open. Crime wasn't such a big thing then. My twin sister and husband ended up getting out. A daughter of one of their best friends was shot and killed at traffic lights, pulled out of a car and car stolen. She was killed. And they decided to start to get out of the country at that stage, come back to New Zealand.
It's wild. We interviewed like a South African on the show, and he would used to drive around Africa, and I think it was installing like energy-related things, like some hardware. And what he'd have to do, even though he didn't smoke, is he'd always have to carry around cigarettes.
Yeah.
Time we got to a police stop, you have to give them. And there was a point where they tried to be a little cheeky. And one of the driver, for whatever reason, just gunned it because he didn't like it, because they're like one of those militia. So he just gunned it and they started shooting through the van. And then had to go to work like nothing happened.
It was, so I think it was my first time, apart from Australia, my first time ever being overseas. And it was the first time I'd ever confronted police with guns. And it was on New Year's Eve, early New Year's Eve, and we had driven down to the waterfront in Durban. We were going to go into town, have a couple of beers, etc. And we drove into a waterfront car park, open car park, the wrong way, apparently. And the next minute, we were surrounded by about four police cars, and they came out with, you know, looked like Uzis or AK-47s or something, whatever, they were, you know, automatic guns. That was probably the most scariest thing I've ever done, seen in my life. It was very scary for a couple of minutes, you know. But first time I'd ever seen police with guns, that was an unusual thing.
Well, it's pretty tough too, because the level of training, I think, is quite low. I was listening to like Navy SEALs describe how the police force is trained.
Yeah.
And you think, just the average human, like I haven't met too many well-adjusted police officers, put it that way. They're a high-stress job. They're alienated and hated by society at the moment. And they have inadequate training around firearms in other nations, that's for sure.
I played golf with one who does a lot of sort of undercover work in terms of just following people. I'm going to say that term. That'll really... We call them all kinds of things and have acronyms for them as well. And to tell him that he's maybe not well-adjusted, that's going to go down well.
Yeah, well, my uncle's a detective, and he's, you know, he's very measured, very methodical. But yeah. I just find with any profession where you're required to be a degree of professionalism and have a high degree of formality, the moment that the work finishes, they're a different beast, you know. You'll see.
Yeah. I've struck that with a few policemen in my time as well, particularly in the rugby fraternity. Yeah, they, inverted commas, can be quite dangerous when they get out socializing, particularly as single guys.
Yeah. Well, funnily enough, your testosterone when you're single is much higher. So your propensity for violence is much higher too. Go figure. You see those guys in a club that they're not getting a girl and they'll just knock a glass over to start something just so they don't have to face their own inadequacies.
Hadn't thought of it that way. But yeah.
So what's I'll be curious, so around the rugby side of things, so leading men in a way where they're open to listening to you, and it's sort of a controlled structure on the field, but it's not easy when they're more potentially physically imposing than you, you're outnumbered, and yet there's a way to communicate where they listen.
It's really interesting because in the last 10 years, I suppose, maybe 15, we've got a lot of very young guys in refereeing. You know, kids starting, and there was a college program where they got NCI credits for taking up a refereeing course. And we've had in Wellington area, a lot of these young kids come out and referee. And it's quite obvious that they had sat and watched a lot of rugby with their parents because they just understood the game. But it's when it's come to, you know, how does a 13, 14, 15-year-old go out and control a game of rugby where the guys are all older than they are and sometimes much older? And yet they just have this calmness and this management facility where they can do that. And that's what it is around. That's what makes the difference between sort of a lot of referees and the best referees, is how do they manage people during the game? Because it's easy to learn the law, even though a lot of people say there's far too many laws. That part of it's quite easy. You can be technically correct whether you're 13 years old or you're 50. But to actually manage people on the ground, guys who think they know the game in and out, they don't even know the law, but to manage them and talk to them and get them through a game, that's a skill. And some people sort of, I think, have it innately, and it just comes out and they can do that because it's the way they talk, the words that they choose, what their face and mannerisms exude. and people just feel maybe a little bit more relaxed around them, so they'll listen. So it's all those kind of elements come through as a referee that make one person probably a much better referee than another.
Yeah, I've heard this concept of intent has a smell. So by that I mean that if you have a leader that genuinely wants the best and is collaborative in the way they approach, even though at times they're telling you off, you can smell their intent.
Yeah,
you can see that they're trying to be good. And I very rarely met someone that's so manipulative and so cunning that you can't really, like, they spring you, you know. I try to buy, first time I got ripped off, I was 14. I tried to buy a telescope and I paid before I got the goods and never saw it. So, You can definitely get burned, but I think if you mean well, no matter how much pressure there is in any given moment and how tough the chat is, I think intent always wins. But is there like a process or a way to be better at refereeing that you've developed over the years, or how do you recognize talent?
So there's a couple elements. There's what you recognize in other people and how it works, and being able to be self-controlled as a referee is incredibly important, because if you're starting to exude a loss of control, yeah, your temperature's going up because things are getting tough, and so your voice is maybe changing. People, when they're face-to-face, they can recognize that. The way that you use your hands and that can become very demonstrative. You start pointing at people, that kind of thing, and people get upset with that. Whereas self-control, being calm, taking deep breaths before you speak, talking to people respectively, with respect, not swearing at them and that type of thing becomes very, very important. If you're not calm, they're not going to be calm. And they're not going to calm down. So to be able to bring people down so you can talk them, you can reason them without having a, obviously as a referee, you can't have a long conversation. The game's got to continue. That's really, really important. And I think, so I do a lot of coaching and assessing of referees. And when you look at someone, you can just see whether people are calm within themselves. And if they're calm within themselves, it makes the job so much easier for them. And they tend to be better referees.
It's interesting that there is stillness. I wonder where that comes from, because I think of attributes that I admire in people often come from things that were hard. Resilience, patience is waiting for what you want. So where do you think, do you see a trend of either upbringing, attitude or values, or historic, you know, sporting achievements? Do you see a trend between exceptional referees and past or pattern?
I think all those elements come into it, you know, and there's obviously for a lot of the vast majority of people and referees, it's what their family lives have been like, how they've been brought up, so their values and that all come through. And if they've been taught respect on the way through, been taught to listen, sometimes taught to just do what they're told, all that comes through and reflects in their refereeing very, very quickly, and you can see it. But I love passion in people. Would hate to see the passion go from people. Hate to see referees lose their passion, but you got to be careful just how that comes out. But I think upbringing allows that to come out in a positive manner, more so than the opposite scenario.
Yeah, I was talking in depth to a forensic psychologist about like how to help people live fulfilling lives. Like what's the 80-20? I don't know if you know the 80-20 concept. So what's the highest leverage activity to help people live fulfilling lives? And we narrowed it down to two things. Was parenting. So from the ages of 0 to 11, we'll define a person more than anything else. Yep. And then I'll how do you correct it? Yeah, green. And then the second piece is environment. You know, so it doesn't matter how often you see a therapist or how supported you feel or how many tools you have. If you're going home to an abusive relationship, friends that don't understand you in a work you hate, you know, you can't rise above it.
But very difficult, I imagine.
Yeah, yeah. So what do you find has been I guess, helpful in your life, one, for dealing with criticism of being a referee, and then also you know, you may have the perfect upbringing. I doubt it. I never met someone that had. And in terms of growing and being more calm in yourself.
So I think upbringing was part of it. Learning to respect other people's opinions and knowing that other people are allowed to have an opinion, first and foremost, however they bring that across to you. And listening in the first instance, and then creating a discussion, but showing someone that you respect their decision for a start, and that you're open to listening to them. I think immediately, you know, can bring their temperature down if they know they're being listened to, whether you agree with that or not. And then often as a referee, of course, you don't agree with it. It's going to be quite a different outcome. And one of the things we use as a referee is saying, look, in our perspective, this is what I saw. This is how I saw you behaving. This is what I saw as a picture for the game. This is how I saw life. That's my perspective. And when people go, like, oh, that's okay, that's his perspective, you're allowed to have your perspective as well. As a referee, of course, you've got the ultimate control of the whistle. But people tend to relate to that more. It's almost like you're being so much more open if you say, well, this is my perspective of things. This is how I saw it. And that, I think, works in life as well. It's a lot less confronting than if you say, this is the way it is.
I find the three most valuable things in an argument, and I don't think people can really win them, is trying to understand them, taking responsibility where it should be taken.
Yeah.
You know, because imagine that someone comes up with it to you all worked up, and they're like, oh, Ryan, like, you didn't do this, you didn't do that. And you're like, yeah, you're right, I'm sorry, I'll fix it. Where does that energy go? It's like,
exactly. Yeah.
So, yeah, go on.
Sorry, carry on.
We're trying to get this timing and pacing right. I haven't quite worked it out. But, yeah, go spin a riff, mate. Go on, you had the floor.
I was going to say, that's exactly right. It's just acknowledging people, that they're being heard. I think it's important, whether it's on a rugby paddock or whether it's in the industry that I'm in insurance or in life. If you just acknowledge people for a start, acknowledge what they're saying, people, you know, trying to get stuff off their chest, and you go, yeah, you're right. Or in your situation, yeah, I'm sorry, I'll go and change it. I'll sort it out, and you're taking some responsibility yourself. It helps.
Yeah, I mean, humans, in my opinion, don't seek the truth. They seek a positive social outcome. You know what I mean? So it's like, okay, gravity doesn't exist. Okay, let's agree gravity doesn't exist for the good of the group. You know, eventually reality is going to hit and then we're going to be confronted. But for the most part, if you have like a setting, a meeting, group of people, they've all got different ideas, but a lot of the ideas are actually, you know, let's say 40% projections of their experiences through life, and they need to win this in order to maintain the identity they've created. So it's not necessarily a pursuit of the truth. It's a pursuit of the affirmation of the identity that they have. But I'd be curious, in insurance, when you're confronted with an objection and someone's like, oh, I don't know about this, I think insurance is bullshit, they don't pay out or whatever. How do you deal with that?
Well, the very first thing is you acknowledge them. You acknowledge what they've said. You can all ask them to explain, or you can say, here's what I heard you say. I'm understanding that your issue is around that, and then get them to agree to that. And immediately that tends to pacify a lot of things and bring it down, and then you can start to work through what that issue may be, acknowledge that sometimes things can be difficult. It might be around people saying, oh, you never get a claim. Insurance is just taking your money. There's never any claim. Well, you go, well, okay, sometimes that can happen. There must be valid claims. You know, why do you say that? Have you experienced someone who hasn't had it? What was the situation? And then you can explain how systems and processes work. And in the main, that generally gets over all those kind of situations. Acknowledging the people is really important.
Yeah, valid. Yeah, I think. They used to teach you the old objection handling, like agree, relate, tell them why they're wrong, and then reimpulse them. It's like it's wild. Like I don't get how that works. But if you actually explore the depth or underlying drivers as to why they're not able to make a decision, it could be like, hey, I don't have the confidence to make a decision myself. So I need you to give me the reassurance that I can partner with my partner and not look bad in their eyes. So it's not so much, hey, the price. It's not so much, oh, the features. It's like, hey, I have this underlying belief that I am giving my power to others because I don't believe in myself to make decisions. Do you find underlying motivations within what stops people making decisions in insurance or sales? Or
yeah, all the time. And if you talk about it and talk about how things work, and in the insurance industry, I'm an advisor. I work for you. I don't work for the insurance company. And so the more that you talk about that, how I'm there to help you at any stage, that you're not committed to anything at all. It's a moment-by-moment proposition, but I am there working for you. We're a team. I'm the intermediary with the insurer. I can work with them to make sure that you're getting what you want, all these type of things. The teamwork, empathy and honesty and being open with them is all comes together to make people feel so much more comfortable about what they're getting, what they're getting into. They're going to be paying money. It can be a big thing. Everyone's under pressure these days, more so probably than ever, around their budgets, and people have to pay a premium. So getting some comfort around what that's going to do for them, how we can change things in the future that they're not absolutely locked into anything, can all help. But acknowledging people and talking to them honestly, having empathy with them, all those things come together, I think.
One of the things I've been struggling with is insurance appears to be something that's begrudgingly paid. And it's not a carrot that's dangled in the sense it doesn't motivate people to show up to appointments. Because that's all I do is I make advertisements and try and make offers that people want and then call them. And so they meet the insurance broker. And I'm not sure what leads to them buying it. I could go the, hey, let's paint the picture of how your life could go wrong. Or, hey, what goals are you trying to achieve? If there was a speed bump, would you be able to achieve that? What have you found is quite useful to create either urgency or a belief in the product?
I think there's a couple of conversations with younger people. They're all 10 foot tall and bulletproof. Nothing's ever going to happen to them. So I think around that scenario, you're talking about everything they're going to build and that the risk of losing, heaven forbid something happens. And so we want you to achieve that. And you're going to do everything you can and put everything in the structures all in place to achieve that. But what if something happens? You're not going to get it. It could be all lost because of one simple little thing, not having this protection in place. So having something, a compromise in between that allows you still, you're going to achieve everything you want to achieve in your life is really important. And sometimes that can be the one that go, oh, okay, I can relate to that. That makes good sense. Whereas you get into people who are a little bit older, they often experience and know people who have suffered, who have had a car accident or a sporting accident that's put them out, been unable to work for a period of time. They may well know people who have got their own businesses who are not going to be covered by necessarily by an employee or employer, I should say, and everything's going to be nice and protected. They're going to have to look after themselves. They go, well, hey, we've seen it in reality, what can happen to people. So, yes, I can understand what you're saying around how this is going to help me. And that's certainly an easier conversation when people have had that life experience and seen other people who have experienced stuff. So it's, once again, listening to people, what are they wanting to achieve, and then what could stop them achieving that? And, hey, I can help you make sure you do that by here's a part of life where you need these risk products just in case.
Interesting. Yeah, the goal front made a lot of sense. So I used to do the financial planning part. So I was a financial planner 4 years and be like, hey, you want to retire? How much do you want to retire? What do you want to do in your retirement? What are your values? What's important about money to you? Choice, freedom, security. It's usually one of those three things. And I didn't apply that to insurance. I kept being like, oh, so what's your motivation? Are you afraid of interest rates? Or like, do you know someone that's health has got fucked? Like, I didn't really, but well, how would you, what sort of questions do you find are really valuable in extracting the underlying drivers for the need for insurance?
Just ask them what's important in their lives. Where do you want to get to? What would stop you getting there? You know, for some people, it's as simple as they just want to have children and watch their children grow up and be successful. And then it's like, well, what if you couldn't do that? What if something happens to one of your children? What do we need? Where can I help that'll make sure that you can to do that? So it's just, yeah, it's probably like the investment side, like finding out what's important to people and then going, well, what can put that at risk? So it's what is that driver, and finding it out and just asking those questions. So, you know, for some people it's possessions rather than family. And then just talking about those things and what could change it, what could put it at risk.
Interesting. Yeah. It's funny because what we used to do is we would ask those questions, identify things that will cause issues in that journey. And one is estate planning, enduring powers of attorney will. The other one is risk management. So we would just say, oh, hey, you need these covers. We can't sell it. We'll go refer you. And now, and now motivated. So yeah, oops, maybe I should have supplied that. Okay.
Yeah. And the other thing is around is not being too narrow. So like some natural things in the insurance industry is talking about people having wills and enduring power of attorneys to make sure, because often insurance just by itself won't work. You can have the ownership wrong, and therefore the money is there, but people can't access it. Or people don't have a will, and now the money's intestate and families have to go through the legal system to get it. It can take a long time. So when people see that you're just not talking and trying to sell them insurance, and that and there are other things that you're referring them on to, and it just helps, I think. And people see that you're on their side, and you're not just you here and them here, and there's a product in between, and how that all comes together. I think people relate to that and understand that and go, okay, this is just another element in my life that I need to put in place to make sure it all works. And the more they see that, the more natural and easier the whole thing becomes. And there are times when me as an advisor, I don't sell anything. All I've done is told them to go to a solicitor or referred them to someone around a will or an enduring power of attorney, for example. Or for me, I don't do fire and general insurance or house and contents, but I've got a bit of knowledge around that and I can talk to them about it in general terms, not giving them advice, of course, because I'm not registered to do that, and then put them on to someone. But they can see that I'm talking about other things in their lives that can be important to them that they could end up losing if they don't have the structures in place. And yet I'm not going to get anything out of it. And that comes across as pretty valuable, I believe.
Well, this is a good lesson. I actually can apply it straight after. But I was reading a book a long time ago, Influence of Psychology Persuasion, and there was a waiter. And the waiter sold more wine than anyone else. And what they did, they asked them, what are you actually doing? And they watched them. He'd go to table. He'd say, this is the most expensive bottle of wine. Garbage. Don't get it. It's actually not that good. The second one is a lot better. Better value for price. So that deliberate going against what you would expect,
yes,
having their best interest at heart, is what drove the sale.
Yep. No, I could understand that and translate that into the insurance industry and a lot of other areas as well. And it comes across as you being honest and maybe understanding. And if they come back and go, no, I want the most expensive one, thanks very much, well, so be it. But for a lot of people, they go, oh, wow. As you say, they don't expect that. They think you're just there to sell, sell, sell. And then they suddenly get someone who's got a little bit of empathy and understanding. And that comes across really well, I think.
That's so silly of me, eh? Like, because, I mean, that's my natural personality is trying to understand people and give value. and it served me well. But as soon as, you know, I was starting to sell insurance, I'm like, oh, just my pretty much the call will go something like, hey, such as Ryan, how you going? Like, good. Well, the reason for the call was you wanted free insurance advice. What insurance were you thinking about? So it just went straight to product and ignored any goals they have. And I think 61.9% of people were turning up to the appointment, which it needs to be 80 to 100.
Yes.
So that's probably why. Do you do that on a, like, if you've got a referral, do you go into the goal part, or what do you talk about usually?
I talk about the human part for a start. Just getting to know them, who are they as a person, not even talking about insurance. So trying to get something to relate to, and have the insurance as a last part, so that when we move on to maybe a second phone appointment, face-to-face, whatever it may be, that becomes secondary.
So, yeah. Yeah, interesting. Oh, well, that was silly. What else have you found is quite useful in terms of insurance, either in the retention side of things? So what clients lead to them keeping the insurance?
Once again, it's getting to know people, understand their situation, what they can potentially move into later in life and why they would need it, and telling them they can reduce cover. Yes, it's time to stop this part, but this is still important. Here's why it can still be important to you, relate it to what the situation. And there are times when it's time to stop it. And it comes way back to, we talked earlier about being honest with people in all kinds of different ways. But there can be a time when it's no longer required. And to be honest about that, don't try and push it, because I've always had a long-term viewpoint around insurance in my industry and my career. And I think if you're only looking at it as it's short-term and just trying to make money, 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 unless you're a particularly good type of salesperson, and stuff's never going to last anyway, you need to have that long-term viewpoint. And if I come to you and all I talk about is your investments, even though I'm not going to give you advice there, and all these other things, and we don't end up selling, I talk to you about wills and enduring power of attorneys and all this other stuff. To me, it's around who you know. Who else do you know? You might know someone who's got a really good business who needs advice. I don't end up doing anything with you, but I might end up talking to that guy because you, or that woman, because you're in a social situation and something comes up and you go, you ought to talk to the guy that I talk to, because he won't sell you anything, but he'll give you some good advice around that, and it won't cost you a penny. That, to me, is where I see it. You end up getting married and having children. You go, oh, now I probably need some of that stuff. I know who I'll talk to. It's that guy, because I know I can get an honest and true perspective on things around my situation now. And if I don't need it, I know I'm not going to be pushed into it. But if I do need it, and he or they can show me why I need it now and I only need a part of it or whatever, well, then that's great. And so, yeah, a good long-term view of being in the industry, and that things will grow naturally because you are honest, you work with integrity, you can explain things to people about when they need it and when they don't, they can be prudent rather than going the whole hog, all those things, I believe they'll come home to fruition at some stage.
Yeah, I actually think that's one of the most underplayed natures of content. So I'm a big believer in the compounding effect of goodwill. I call it brand equity. And I think when you see people out there that are making content, they're all like one-night stands. They're all like, hey, buy my stuff.
Yeah.
Imagine you went to a networking event every week, a new one, and just didn't ask anything about the person, just said, hey, buy my stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas if you imagine if you could go to a networking event and, you know, we were getting something like 400,000 views a month on just the little clips. You imagine you could do that every month, so stood in front of 400,000 people, and you just keep making content, giving value. Oh, by the way, I do insurance. Giving value. And how that would compound. And it hasn't really landed in the professional services where they're like, you know what? that human is consuming my content. Oh no, social media doesn't work. But what have you found is the most surprising benefit of acting with good integrity in business?
Just that people come back to you at very unexpected times. And it's like, someone ringing you and saying, look, I saw you, or my friend told me to contact you because you did this and you helped them with that. And I heard that you could do the same for me. And that, it doesn't happen often, but when it does, it's very satisfying. And knowing that then you're already in a genuine conversation because they've come to you. So that's good. But I'm a great believer in that aspect of my industry that I'm in. Absolutely. And I think it's just the way you should act anyway.
Well, it's just
and good things will come.
Massively. It's the same thing with authenticity. A lot of people are scared. I've had three people asked me on the podcast in the last month, and then they recorded it and they didn't want to post it. Either fear of judgment, they'd stuttered, or they shared something they regretted. And it's, I feel like so much of, like, I mean, I get it. I worry what people think of me. I like to be called pretty once in a while, you know. But why do you think there's such a...
I'm not going to call you pretty.
Aren't you? Oh, yeah, get weird. At least we're remote, so, you know, it's not awkward in person. What do you think people are so afraid of, you know, and what people think of them? Why are people not being authentic and vulnerable if it is such a beautiful thing?
That's an interesting question there. Once, I think sometimes because, you know, social media these days is there, and people can cut you down remotely and criticize you, and people become concerned about that and worried about that. Probably shouldn't to a great degree, but that's there. So yeah, a lot of people don't want to put themselves out because of that. And you may say something silly, but I think it still comes back to honesty. I mean, if you say something and it feels like it comes out wrong, well, then just admit to it and apologize for it if required, genuinely, of course. Not by text. Actually, maybe ring them and have a conversation, or go and see them, as maybe a very well-known politician's finding out right at this very moment. Won't name her, but I think it's got to be, if you do it, hey, everyone makes mistakes. No one's perfect. So make the mistake. You learn from mistakes. If you stutter or say something wrong, just at the time, say it. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to say that. I meant, what I actually meant was this. People will accept that if you come across as being genuine. Allow yourself to make mistakes. You're allowed to make mistakes. Everyone does. And you're always going to. And great learning tools. But if you admit it right at the time, deal with it at the time, get on with it, it's gone.
Yeah, I think why people get cancelled is an inconsistency of image. I don't think it's the action in itself. You know, there's been people that have done horrible things that are still loved. And I think it's those ones that front, like, I'm this kind of person. Oh, wait, you've got that view? Oh, you think like that? Oh, you did that? And then that mistrust and misunderstanding of that person is, I think, what compounds them being cancelled.
Yeah, all that can. And people change. I hear, oh, you know, gosh, you know, things about politicians, what they did as a kid. Really? People, what they did 10, 15 years ago does not mean they think the same today. So many influences, our environment changes us. We rethink, for a lot of people, they will rethink and grow and develop. And their thoughts today and the way they think about something may be completely different to what it was 10 or 15 years ago. What you did as a child when you really didn't think about consequences, well, for a lot of people, they don't think about consequences that's going to do. What relevance has that got to today when it's maybe 5, 10, 15 years later? Let the people make the mistakes, acknowledge them, say that you've changed or they've changed, and get on with it, because I am the age of what I am, but I'm still learning every day. And I'll keep hopefully developing and changing my mind about things as I learn more, as I learn more about insurance and keep learning about the different aspects of it and the policy wordings and how they apply, and going in and studying those and learning how it can benefit a client or anything outside in the whole wide world. People keep learning and are going to learn every day. Their environment's going to shape them. The world keeps changing. You're going to get shaped by that. You have to adapt to it and evolve. If you don't, you're in trouble. But bring all that back. That's what's going to change you and how you relate to people and what you talk about and what you think.
Well, just on the...
if that makes any sense at all.
No, it made sense, mate. You have my vote. It was a good spiel. I'd be curious, so you talk about, well, one, people might want to know how old you are.
I'm 70.
70, yeah. Oh, sprung. What's the secret?
Unfortunately, hard to believe. I find it hard to believe. It was like, my gosh, how did that happen? You know, kids grow up and they grow up so quickly and you go, well, they're fine, let them grow up. I just want to stay the same age I was. But to me, it's all about attitude. Keep talking to people. That's what I love about my industry. I talk to people all the time. Including younger people, keeps you young. Talking, keeping involved in things, being physically active, but mentally active, I think is really, really important. And for me, long may it continue. I'm looking forward to the next 30 years.
I'd be curious.
Plus.
Yeah. Well, I think plus over 100, yeah, Jesus. It's possible. Someone's Googled said that you could live to 150. Like people have already been born.
Well, in your generation, so I've done my age. How old are you?
33.
Right. So your generation and people being born today are very likely to live to 130, 150, so they say, the way things are going. Who knows what the world's going to be like next year, let alone 50 years' time.
Mm.
But in terms of us as people, and health and the way medicine's going and everything else, it could be very realistic. And as long as you have your mental and also hopefully your physical, why would you not want to live that long?
Yeah, true.
Younger people go, oh, I don't want to live that long. Maybe they might want to say that. But when you get a little bit older, it's like, ooh, 100's not that far away now. I'm pretty keen on getting to 100.
That'd be wild.
Not too quickly. I hope that takes a lot longer maybe. But yeah, very keen to be 100 years old and still having a beer and maybe going out and hitting a golf ball 50 metres down the fairway.
Beautiful, 50 metres, it's an achievement. Just on the 70, the ageing and the young, like what sort of lessons from mistakes or failures have been valuable to you that you could, someone listening, that at risk of making those mistakes, could learn from?
I think just learning to accept them and move on, discuss them with people. What other people's viewpoints are there? Because mistakes can be on a whole spectrum, can't they? And you can be something that under law and under common decency may be horrific versus anywhere else along the spectrum to something very minor. So just admitting them for a start to yourself and going, I made a mistake. What am I going to do about it? Do I need to do anything about it? Talking to people about it, what needs to be done. Not everything you need to take on yourself. Sharing things with people, I think, is a great one. Being honest with people, but talking. And it's, you know, we hear so much today around mental health. And particularly guys, just not talking, taking it all within, being tough. Well, I think those days really are well gone. But the more you can be open and talk to people, just admit things, because they've made a mistake as well. Everyone's made a mistake of some sort. Or whatever it may be, someone may well have experienced something similar to you. So if you just talk and be honest and open, and show a bit of vulnerability, I think people relate to that, and they'll come back in their own way if you're like that. it's empathy, I suppose, isn't it?
To a degree.
A lot of involvement in that as well.
Yeah, I think it's only something I've learned last year about vulnerability. I never felt close to anyone because I just didn't let them. And just that feeling of vulnerability and connection, it's like when someone accepts you for who you really are, arguably the highest thing you can ever achieve, I think. I don't know. I've never felt like this till recently, so.
Yeah. So family is important. I mean, if you can, you've always been open as a family, loving, you got the hugs, you've been able to talk to your family, and that through the teenage years, that can be difficult. But if you come back to that, that can be helpful. So people who don't have that, they've lost family through accidents or whatever it may be, or split ups, all those kind of things, that they've lost an aspect that they can very easily go to. So then to go and try and find someone else that they can open up to and be close to and be vulnerable to, I can imagine that can be tough. It's definitely no excuse for doing anything wrong, that's for sure. And I'm very clear about that you can't use an excuse to go and break the law. Everyone pretty much in the main knows what's right or wrong. It can help explain, but it doesn't make it right if you've done something wrong. But to find someone or people where you can open up to and be vulnerable and know that you're not going to be judged, it's important. And when you've found that, I think that's a great part of your life.
It's huge. And I'm just curious on the life journey aspect. Is there like a theme or challenge throughout your life that was something that you've continued to work on and got lessons from? So by that, I mean, you might have a problem with authority, you know, feeling good enough or having a chip on your shoulder, or, you know, deflecting with humor. Was there something as a young man that you found as a challenge that you're sort of unraveling as you get older?
Talking to people, talking in front of people. Talking to women when I was young, I was probably quite shy around that. And to find, and I'm maybe surprisingly or not, I'm not probably the most talkative type person. And I've challenged myself as I've got older, and now I find it a lot more easy because I do it a lot, but I still work at that. Whereas earlier in my life, I found it quite difficult and I had to force myself to do it, look people in the eye, and just get on with it. But if you do challenge yourself and you keep working at it, things come to fruition.
Just like this podcast. So
just like this podcast.
Thanks for coming on.
A little bit nervous earlier on, as you talked about, but talking with you, you make it very comfortable, very easy.
Well,
so thank you.
Thank you.